essentially, you can see that the definition of Britishness, it's based on whiteness.
Willkommen zum Podcast Melting Pot. Migration im Dialog. In diesem Podcast sprechen wir mit NachwuchswissenschaftlerInnen aus verschiedensten Fachgebieten, die zum Thema Migration forschen. Ein Einblick also in die Migrationsforschung über die Grenzen wissenschaftlicher Disziplinen hinweg. Organisiert wird der Podcast vom Nachwuchsnetzwerk des Interdisziplinären Zentrums für Integrations- und Migrationsforschung an der Universität Duisburg-Essen.
Hello and welcome to another English language episode of the Melting Pot podcast, Migration and Dialogue. I am Dennis and I will moderate this episode in cooperation with my dear colleague Laura. Hey Laura.
Hey.
Okay, so let's quickly address the elephant in the room. We will have the general elections in Germany on February 23rd. And of course, we want to recommend everybody to go out to vote. But let's leave it at that for the moment. We also find that immigration policy is a dominant campaign issue in this cycle, with an established negative frame and dysfunctional discourse logics with which frame migrants as threats and are more obsessed with issue than policy. Nevertheless, one has to be careful about those discourse logics, even on the more, let's say, positive frame. In this sense, it would be fruitful to critically question if even the more positive news items we have can overcome this underlying discourse logic on migration. We therefore want to move away from the German case and instead consider a case which is perhaps less familiar to most people, the case of the public perception of Hong Kong immigrants in the UK and specifically the British National Overseas Visa Scheme. For this topic, we invited an expert, as usually, who is Yanis Wong, a PhD student at the Department of Anglophone Studies at University of Duisburg-Essen, who studies this topic for his dissertation. We hope that he can help us understand to which extent those problematic discourse dynamics are embedded in seemingly positive media discourse. Welcome, Sai.
Hi, everyone. I'm Yanis Wong. And as Dennis has told all of you, I'm doing my PhD project on this particular migrant group. And today I'm to answer all the questions they have prepared for me.
That's what we like to hear. Hi, Yanis, and hi, Dennis, from my side as well. Before we dive into our main topic today, let's start with our typical either-or questions. So the Grammys have just been awarded and soon the Oscars will follow. Which one do you find the most interesting, Yanis? Or which one has you more invested, or do you follow these things at all?
I think I pay more attention to the Oscars because I remember in the past, I really watched all 10 nominations for the best pictures and choose which one I like the most. But for Grammys, I don't know. I just listen to music without thinking about, okay, which songs or which artists get more recognition. So I would say Oscars is closer to my heart.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that's a clear answer. Thank you for that. Now, I mean, I know not all disciplines make a strict distinction between quantitative and qualitative research, and I have no idea how it is in Anglophone studies. Mm. So if there is such a thing, which one do you tend to use more?
Definitely in the study of English linguistics, we also have more qualitative approach and more quantitative mm-hmm. approach. But for me personally, I use a mixed approach. Later when we talk about my research more in depth, I will tell you how I first use quantitative approach, in particular with corpus tools, to get an overall image of my data set. Then, followed by that, I do a more in-depth qualitative analysis. So for me, I would say I love the two of them, both of them equally.
So a combination of both that we will definitely talk about later on. But your research focuses on the British National Overseas Visa Scheme, or BNO for short, as I just learned. And that was launched in 2021 as a tailored immigration route for these BNO status holders from Hong Kong. And as someone like me who knows little to nothing about it, I'm going to need a little bit more context. And what I mean with that is, I know that the UK and Hong Kong have a particular relationship, but could you talk a little bit more about that first?
Okay. Hong Kong was a British colony from 1842 to 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And the colonial period began after the First Opium War, where Britain gained control of Hong Kong Island through the Treaty of Nanking.
Mm-hmm.
And the British also leased the new territories, which is the biggest part in Hong Kong, which expanded the Hong Kong's geographical boundaries. And from then on, Hong Kong operated as a strategic outpost for Britain in Asia, serving as a major port and trade hub. And over the years, because Hong Kong was governed by the British, and the territory developed its own identity, its own political system, its own social welfare scheme. So I would say that the British implemented a lot of differences in Hong Kong, and therefore the people in Hong Kong has a different mentality when it comes to the idea of democracy or mm-hmm. liberal values. That's why when it comes to the recent year, for example, in 2014, there was a huge protest, which is called the Umbrella Movement. The major reason for this protest is people wanted more democracy as promised. So this is one of the major protests in Hong Kong after the handover in 1997. And if we look at 2019, there was even a more violent, bigger protest, which is called the Anti-Extradition Law Movement,
mm-hmm.
because people saw that Beijing tried to control the city in the areas of legal system, and in a way that suspects of some particular crimes could be extradited to the mainland, which alarmed a lot of people. That's why people came out to protest against this encroachment of the legal system. This is actually the major reason why the UK government launched the BNO visa, because according to their narratives, through their official narratives, they saw this national security law implemented by the PLC as a breach of the Sino-British Joint Declaration. So that because they felt they have a certain moral obligation to the people in Hong Kong, that's why they launched this BNO visa scheme to facilitate the move from Hong Kong to the UK for this particular group of people who retain a certain ties with the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm. I will just say it for our listeners once more. BNO stands for British National Overseas. So we will hear BNO much more throughout this episode, I think. But now that you mention it, what exactly is the BNO visa scheme? I mean, you talked about it a little bit, but what rights are or are not attached to it?
I would say the British National Overseas nationality it's a really unusual form of nationality. Mm-hmm. It was created specifically for Hong Kong residents before the 1997 handover. It is different from both full British citizenship and other British nationality categories. There are six British nationalities. And it was introduced in the 1980s as a part of Britain's preparation for handing Hong Kong back to the PRC. Before that, in Hong Kong, people were considered British Dependent Territory Citizens, BDTC, which was a more general category which Hong Kong people share with residents in, for example, Gibraltar, in Bermuda. But since Hong Kong was going to be transferred to China, and the UK government created this very special British National Overseas Status as a way for Hong Kong people to maintain a nominal connection to Britain without actually giving them full British citizenship.
Oh.
So in one sentence, BNO is a UK passport without citizenship rights.
See, and you called it this citizenship injustice, right?
Yeah.
Why? Could you go more into it, please?
Yeah, because if we have to consider the BNO category, we must see it as a series of nationality change undergo in the British nationality and immigration regime. Because before 1962, before the Commonwealth Immigration Act, all British subjects enjoyed the same right when it comes to the right of abode, a UK legal term referring to the legal right to live and work in the UK. But after the Second World War, a lot of so-called new Commonwealth migrants were going to the United Kingdom, which alerted some politicians or some people that, oh, should we allow even more new Commonwealth immigrants into the country? That's why in 1962, as I mentioned, the Commonwealth Immigration Act, the right of abode, the legal right to work and live in the UK was taken away from these Commonwealth citizens. From then on, for immigration purpose, they were considered aliens or they have some marginal benefit compared to people with no connection with the UK. So this is when Hong Kong people who were under the British Empire, who were considered at least legally British, they lost the right to move to the UK based on, from my perspective, I would say based on a racialized reason. Because if we talk about decolonization of the United Kingdom, it is essentially a process when where the British redefine who should belong to the United Kingdom from a vast empire across the globe to a island nation that we come to know today.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, not everyone from the empire could be accommodated in the tiny nation. So essentially, decolonization for the UK means the process of defining who can remain and who should be kept out of the nation.
Okay.
So I would say a lot of new Commonwealth, or rather derogatory or a rather sensitive term or political incorrect term, the coloured Commonwealth citizens, they were kept out of the United Kingdom as a result of decolonization. But if we look at, for example, the New Zealanders, the Australian, they can still use their ancestry. For example, if my grandparents, one of my grandparents, my grandfather was British, I can still apply to go to United Kingdom. Essentially, you can see that the definition of Britishness, it's based on whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I would call, some kind of injustice in the immigration regime, because non-white individuals were not having the same privilege enjoyed by white individual or white descendant of the British Empire.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, thank you very much for giving us this context. So now we understand or have an idea or a notion about what you're looking at. What is your research question exactly in this case?
My research question is to understand how are the Hong Kong migrants discursively constructed in government and news discourses.
Mm-hmm. And you said you're using a qualitative and quantitative method approach, so a combination of both.
Mm-hmm.
And you told us before that you use a discourse historical approach.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a notion of discourse analysis, but yeah, what exactly is discourse historical approach?
Well, why don't I walk through how I analyze my data set?
Yes, please. Mm-hmm.
So the school of thinking that I subscribe to is called critical discourse studies or critical discourse analysis. It is a way to analyze language to understand how power works in society. The basic idea is that the way we talk about things doesn't just describe or reflect reality. It also shapes it. For example, when politicians or the media talk about migrants, for example, they are not just reflecting what is out there. They are not just reflecting the so-called fact. Their words also influence how people see or perceive those migrants. And that's why when it comes to election or policy debate, some policies get supported and some don't. Essentially because of how the politician or the media help us understand a particular policy or particular issue in society. For example, when it comes to migration, some migrant groups are very stigmatized in the political discourse and the media discourse. For example, for less quality media, they simply reproduce what the government has to say. Then with this accumulative effect, the society of the general public who read news, they eventually form the idea that, oh, some migrant groups are more violent, some groups are more deserving. So this is how I, as a critical discourse analyst, have to look up to, like, what ideologically charged statements, what biases are being naturalized, are presented as common sense, are presented as some taken for granted fact.
Ah, okay. Okay, that is very interesting, the idea of how discourse and power are actually deeply intertwined. But could we go a bit more deeper in your actually data and your data analysis? Which data sets are you analyzing with this discourse analysis approach?
So for my whole PhD project, I analyzed three data sets. The first one is the government policies and debate on the BNO visa scheme. And the second data source is the newspaper, how newspaper recontextualize or reproduce what the government said about this visa scheme. And the third data set is I will interview the BNO migrant themselves to see how they perceive their representation in society at large, and how is their lived experience different from what is being presented or represented in the government and media narratives.
Okay, and you told us in the pre-interview that you already have preliminary results on your media analysis. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we would be really interested in you sharing those with us. And those are, could you say again, which actually media data set did you analyze? And but we can get into that later. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah. So about your media data set.
My approach combines both quantitative and qualitative methods to examine how the BNO migrants are constructed in political and media discourses. This is known as corpus-assisted discourse studies, CADS, which allows me to identify recurring themes and patterns across a large data set, rather than relying solely on close reading of, let's say, 10 newspaper articles. As of now, I have analyzed a corpus of 145 articles from The Guardian, discussing the BNO visa scheme applicant. So, corpus-assisted discourse studies, or CADS, use corpus linguistics tools to analyze a large collection of texts, such as government policy documents or more often news articles. One key technique is keyword analysis, which identifies words and phrases that appear significantly more often in the data set compared to a general reference corpus. This helps highlight what is unusually prominent in the data set. For example, I found a lot of words and phrases about democracy, pro-democracy, seeking refuge, asylum seeking, like this kind of words. When The Guardian talk about the BNO migrants, then it already gave me the idea that, okay, so the BNO migrants are seen as refugees predominantly in the Guardian reporting.
Okay, so if I got that right, you're analyzing in the newspaper corpora which words appear around Hong Kong migrants, and the words how the media use to refer to them. Are there any patterns in how the media refers to this group and how this group actually describes themselves?
Well, I can only answer the first half of the question because I haven't interviewed them, but I can tell you. It would be useful as well if I tell you what critical discourse studies have been doing when it comes to refugees or asylum seekers. Most of the studies focus on how a newspaper, particularly the tabloid, attacked the refugees, for example, by dehumanizing into some numbers. For example, if we read on the in the news, like, oh, Home Office received another 2,000 applications last week, then essentially these people who are applying for refugee status are reduced to applications. They are just treated as some step, some bureaucratic step in the system. So this is not a this is rather dehumanizing in my opinion. And the general trend in critical discourse studies focusing on these dehumanizing or reducing trend in the newspaper articles. But my focus is a little bit different because as a matter of fact, the Hong Kong migrants received rather positive and lenient representation in both government and newspaper articles. That's why I want to see how they're doing that. And more importantly, why they're doing that. What can this so-called positive representation can inform us about the change in the broader discourse on migration?
Okay. So could you say, maybe give us some quick context what you mean with the positive frame, the unusual positive frame, actually, of Hong Kong migrants in the broader context of migrants? What is, you said that they are not de-individualized, but what also do you find there?
One quick example I can tell you is that the BNO Hong Kongers, they are linguistically referred to holders of some kind of British passport. An example I can reach out is from The Guardian is the current scheme is available only to BNO passport holders born before 1997. So if we look at this, it might sound very neutral, right? Because, well, it is fact, they are BNO passport holders. But if we think more, engage with this sentence more critically, Guardian essentially is reproducing the fact that these people have some ties with the United Kingdom. They are not entirely strangers to the United Kingdom. They have some kind of passport. So, in other words, they are more legitimate, they are more deserving than other migrant groups out there, because The Guardian could also have represented them as Chinese, ethnic Chinese from Hong Kong are coming to the United Kingdom through this scheme. But by focusing on their ethnic background rather than their legal status, The Guardian is essentially, if not actively telling a story, they are also reproducing the image that, oh, these Hong Kong people, they hold British passport, they are coming to the UK. The whole narrative is much more legitimized than when we compare to other migrants that may that is other migrants that are coming through the English channels by small boat. Then you immediately see the contrast. Oh, one group is more legitimized than the other.
Okay, I get that. But you also mentioned that the idea is to move beyond the text level into a discourse level, into a social level. And that is also something we would be also be very interesting to explain those different constructions and presentations of different groups. You already mentioned that, for example, the news media is very very explicit if they communicate the historic ties from Hong Kong migrants to the United Kingdom. But you mentioned in the previous pre-interview that they are also very selective about which parts of history they want to address. For example, could you talk about, could you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, you're right. I have noticed that The Guardian also used a strategy which is called de-agencialization in our field, which is essentially the omission of the decision-making process or who made the decision. For example, well, as I as we have walked through the whole BNO status, how it came to be, it is we know that it is there has to be a person or a party that made a decision that okay, these Hong Kong residents would not get the full British citizenship. But in present day reporting, we only see that they talk about how BNO status was given to Hong Kong residents, or these people hold what is known as a BNO passport. You can see that this the decision making process, who is responsible for making this decision, it's being omitted. It's so even though these Hong Kong people are being attributed to some kind of connection with the United Kingdom by holding some kind of second class passport, but the fact that some British politicians in the past who have decided to take away their right of abode to the United Kingdom was rarely mentioned. So this is what I call, I hope I answered your question, like how they somehow mention, emphasize that Hong Kong people had some kind of historical ties with the United Kingdom without explicitly stating that, oh, the United Kingdom also has the responsibility for this wave of migration.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, I get that. That is really interesting that they talk about ties and not that they actually shape those ties themselves.
Exactly.
So I see that they are very selective in how they want to talk about the past political decisions that that shaped this situation. But there are also a present day incentives in constructing Hong Kong migrants separately from other migrants. Did you find any evidence of that?
A very good question. One thing that I have I have given attention is that there is a narrative among the UK politicians is that they have some kind of safe and legal routes for people who need humanitarian support. And this so-called safe and legal routes is in parallel to the usual, to the more conventional asylum seeking process. So basically, there are two systems of granting humanitarian support in the UK right now. One is the more traditional approach based on the Geneva Convention after the Second World War, with the with which is modeled after the United Nations Convention. And on top of that, the UK is pushing a so-called safe and legal route tailor-made for particular nationalities. For example, for Hong Kong people who is leaving Hong Kong because of the political the change in the political climate, as well as the Ukrainians and the Afghans. So what I saw in their narrative is that whenever UK politicians are being asked or criticized for not doing enough for asylum seekers, they would use examples of this safe and legal route to argue that, oh no, you're wrong. We have done enough. We are very generous. We are being very fair with our approach to offering humanitarian support. Let's look at the Hong Kong scheme, the Ukrainian scheme, the Afghan scheme. But the problem with that is these schemes, even though they are grouped under the safe and legal route umbrella, but they have very different rights and obligations coming with the particular scheme. For example, with the Hong Kong scheme, the Hong Kong BNO visa scheme, people, the applicants generally do not have access to public fund. They have to pay the international fee when they want to go to the tertiary education in the UK instead of home fee. But the thing is, they have a very clear path of to settlement. After 5 years, they can get the indefinite leave to remain status. And after that, they can apply for British citizenship. On the other hand, with the Ukrainians, with the Ukrainian scheme, they have access to public fund. But what they lack is they don't know if they can remain in the UK. Unlike with the Hong Kong migrants, they know exactly after 6 years they will become full British citizens. The Ukrainian do not. So you can see that by the comparison of these two groups of visa holders. So even though they are under the same so-called safe and legal routes, they face very different challenges. And some for the Hong Kong migrants, they have a clearer future. But for the Ukrainians, their future is much less certain. So this is the problem I see when the UK government tried to group everything together into this so-called safe and legal routes. But their lived experience of these applicants are very, very different. And I think it's not that comparable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can see how the UK government is using this safe and legal narrative to legitimize, on the other hand, maybe a more restrictive policy that falls is besides those very narrow criterions they set themselves. You mentioned previously that that one of your objective is to compare the government perspective to the press perspective, and you introduced us to your findings. But would you say finally, is there a difference between the how big is the difference between the press and government perspective, or how is the press actually doing justice to the role to holding the government critically accountable?
As of now, I would say The Guardian is largely reproducing what the government has told the public about the BNO migrant group. For example, one thing that The Guardian failed to ask is why these Hong Kong people have a UK passport without the right of abode in the UK. Instead of engaging this critically, to uncover what injustice that we talk about. Why did the UK government take away the right of abode in the first place? They just accepted it. The Guardian just accepted it that, okay, this is normal. Hong Kong people have some kind of passport and now they're coming here as migrants. But if we think more critically, this is very absurd. Why would a passport holder why would a UK passport holder consider migrants when they move to the UK?
Mm-hmm.
So instead of asking what historical circumstances has brought these Hong Kong people to this situation, The Guardian simply just accepted that, okay, this is normal. So this is something mm-hmm. that I think they should be more critical about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think that's really interesting because you not only contrast how The Guardian constructs Hong Kong migrants and what image it helps to naturalize, but you also provide responses as to what questions we should be asking instead, which is really, really interesting. And I think it's an important further step to your research mm-hmm. that you provide with that.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for your insights and also for your time today. Unfortunately, we have already reached the end of this episode. There's nothing left for us to do but ask you if there's anything else you would like to add, or if there's anything that has perhaps been missed out in the last couple of minutes. So the last words are yours.
I would say that by investigating the BNO visa scheme, I uncovered a very interesting nexus of how colonialism, persons draw political conflict, mm-hmm. and race, and immigration, how these things all come together to make this case of Hong Kong migrants really unique. The intersectionality of this case really help us to rethink some taken for granted ideas when we talk about migration. For example, these Hong Kong BNO scheme visa applicants, even though they are represented as migrant, but on the other hand, they have a form of UK passport. But in daily life, when we talk about passport, we almost always indicate that it is the same with citizenship. For example, when I tell someone that I have a German passport or I have a US passport, what I mean actually is I have the citizenship, I have the right to vote, I have the right to run for election in that country. But in this particular case, for Hong Kong migrants, this is not the case. They just have a passport as a travel document instead of a passport associated with citizenship right. So I think we can be more critical to engage with some taken for granted idea. When we analyze migration, we can see more insight and how even as scholars, how sometimes we are not critical enough and just followed the long tradition of how particular words are used.
All right, be more critical. That's what I take away with this episode. Thank you very much. Really important words, especially nowadays. So thank you again, Yannis, for your time. Thank you, Dennis, for hosting this episode with me. And of course, thank you to our listeners. And until next time. Bye.
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 Das war's mit dieser Ausgabe des Podcasts Melting Pot. Migration im Dialog. Für mehr Informationen über die Arbeit unseres Netzwerkes und für Updates zum Podcast findet ihr uns auf Twitter unter @incenten. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal.